It's a story about how an innocent man was sent to death row.
And race played a huge part in
Huge part of it. The victim was a white, elderly white widow found stuffed in her closet in Greenwood, South Carolina. And within 36 hours, they had arrested Edward Lee Elmore, a 23-year-old semi-literate black man. And 90 days later, he had been tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. A friend of mine who read the book said it was a legal lynching.
And the setting mattered a lot.
Yes, I mean, this was 1982. They had only integrated the high school in 1969. And even today, the war memorial in Greenwood, South Carolina, the plaques for World War I and World War II, the men who died, are divided between whites and coloreds. And a lawyer in town recently, last year, he offered to pay for new plaques in which the dead would be listed alphabetically, not by race. And the American Legion Post refused.
And when you investigated, you found that there was very little evidence. There was fingerprints, but he had been working at the house, so it could have been from that. They claimed that there was hair on the bed, but never shared that hair with anyone, nor did they have any photographs that would have tied Elmore to the case. And then there was this black pubic hair that they claimed to have, but which later upon DNA testing turned out was not an African-American hair. What do you make of that?
You know, you have to have probable cause to arrest somebody, and that means a reasonable person would have said that this evidence is a basis for arresting the individual. The only evidence they had when they arrested him was a fingerprint by the back door and a check that the victim, Mrs. Edwards, had given to him. But Elmore had been there legally, washing windows 2 weeks before. So that was not probable cause. And then at trial, they introduced evidence to connect him to the crime. And among them was these 53 pubic hairs they found on the bed. They claimed to find on the bed. Well, first of all, Emily, if they found 53 pubic hairs, it's a Guinness Book of Records, because you never find more than 8 or 10 in a rape scene. And second of all, as you said, they never took any pictures of the bed. They took pictures of the bed in the guest bedroom where nothing happened. They took no pictures of Mrs. Edwards' bed where they claimed to have found the 53 pubic hairs. And they didn't take the sheets as evidence, because they said we didn't see any stains or blood on them. Now, this woman have been sexually assaulted on the bed and 53 pubic hairs fall out or come out, and yet there's no stains and no blood? Fact is, there were no hairs on the bed. Nah, but your listeners ask, but wait a minute. Those hairs were identified later as Elmore's. That's right, because when he was arrested, they pulled out an inordinate number of pubic hairs. The evidence was never sealed while it was in police headquarters. So those hairs they pulled out, the state claimed, were found in the bed. They weren't.
Is part of the conclusion that we can draw in a greater sense that the police were hungry to wrap up the case, the prosecutor was hungry for a win, and they were willing to interfere?
Absolutely. The police were in a hurry. As police are. I mean, police want to solve crimes. And here you had the community, you had little old ladies, very nervous, very worried. And so the police could say within 36 hours, we've found the perpetrator. But they hadn't. And the prosecution, yeah, that's the problem. Prosecutors want to win. And that's not their ethical obligation. Their ethical obligation is to do justice. Now, sometimes, many times, even most times, a conviction equals justice, but not all the time.
Why did you get involved in this case out of all the cases?
Two reasons. One is his case has all the elements of the death penalty debate: mental retardation, snitch testimony, DNA testing, bad trial lawyers, prosecutorial misconduct, claim of innocence, strong claim of innocence. But the other reason is because of the lawyer on appeal, Diana Holt. I mean, Diana Holt is, as I say in the book, sui generis. Absolutely. There's nobody like Diana Holt. And if it hadn't been for the combination of her story, her own personal story, which is a story of real inspiration, what she overcame from child abuse, badly abused as a child, to a husband who tried to kill her, to actually having spent time in prison herself for a felony conviction. So it was Diana Holt's story and then the anatomy of injustice that marked Elmore's story. It was the two reasons.
Do you hope that the book will inspire future Diana Holtz?
I think Diana Holt inspires her own future Diana Holtz. I mean, yes. I mean, someone who read it, a friend said it's a story of the damage that bad lawyers can do and an inspirational story of what a good one can do. Yes, I would hope young law students read it and want to become Diana Holt.
But it's really troubling that there are thousands of people on death row. And, you know, if a Diana Holt comes along and finds the evidence, then that's their lucky day. But many of them will not have an innocence project or a lawyer who will take a special interest in them. How do you feel about that?
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, Edward Lee Elmore's first break was when Diana Holt got the case after he'd been on death row for 11 years. And she spent, you know, the next 20 years basically fighting for his freedom. You know, some people sometimes say, oh, only 5% of the men on death row are innocent, or maybe it's even 1%. Let's just assume it's only 1%. So the police say, okay, we're going to line up 100 people. Will you get in that lineup when you know there's only one of you is going to be shot, only one of you going to be executed? Are you going to be, you're going to get in that lineup of 100 people if it's only 1%? To say nothing if it's 5% or 10%.
There's a big difference in this case between the court-appointed lawyers that defend Elmore and the prosecutors. Do you see that as the key to part of the problem with our criminal justice system?
Actually, Emily, for a long time, and when I was writing about the death penalty when I started this book back in 2000, there's been a lot of focus on bad defense lawyers, drunken defense lawyers, sleeping defense lawyers. I mean, the famous Fifth Circuit opinion in which the judges said, you have a right to a lawyer, but it doesn't mean he has to be awake. I mean, it's appalling. I don't think enough attention has been paid to the other side of the equation, which is the prosecutors. And I think the instances of prosecutorial misconduct are far greater than we've paid attention to. And in this case, it's prosecutorial misconduct writ large. I mean, here you have evidence that the police planted evidence and lied. Even the Fourth Circuit, in an opinion in this case, the Federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia last November used the words outright dishonest and deceit to describe the police handling of this case. Now, that is pretty strong language coming from a federal court of appeals, and that alone should trigger an investigation by the Justice Department.
What gives you hope about the future of the death penalty? I mean, we're fighting it in California. Most likely it will be on the ballot in November. Or what worries you?
I think we, 50 years from now, we'll look back on the death penalty, or you or your grandchildren will look back on the death penalty 50, 75 years from now, and just like we look back on slavery now and say, how could we have ever engaged in such barbaric conduct? You have to realize we are about the only democracy in the world that still has the death penalty. I noticed the other day Belarus executed two people. I mean, that's the people we're in league with, Belarus and you know, Syria and Iraq and China, elsewhere. But democratic countries, all of Europe has eliminated the death penalty. And the Europeans, I live in Europe, and the Europeans look at the American death penalty and they really can't understand it. They just don't get it. I live in Britain, and Britain doesn't have the death penalty. And there's no movement to reinstate the death penalty.
You said that often innocence isn't enough. What did you mean by that?
Look at Elmore's innocent. And there are other cases. I mean, the Supreme Court once said in a death penalty case, evidence of innocence is not enough. That's not enough to get you a new trial. Just because you come forward on appeal after you've been tried and convicted, no matter how shaky the conviction, innocence is not enough to get you a new trial. And look at the case of Edward Lee Elmore. Look at the number of times courts turned down his request for a new trial. And even when they gave him a new trial, it wasn't because of the evidence of innocence. It was because his defense lawyers had behaved so appallingly.
And he's had to admit guilt in order to get out of jail. How does that work?
You have a right to find it very perplexing and disturbing. He had to enter a plea. I was in court in Greenwood on March 2nd, basically saying, his lawyer, Diana Holt, stood up and said, Mr. Elmore was not there. He didn't commit the murder. He wasn't in the house. He wasn't there. But he's going to plead guilty in order to get out of prison. He had been, as the judge noted, in prison for 11 thousand days. 30 years. He was 23 when he went in. He's now 53 years old. The state of South Carolina hadn't played fair with him for 30 years, had planted evidence, had, you know, there was evidence of perjured testimony, and he just couldn't take a chance that he'd get a fair trial the next time around. So he pleaded guilty to a crime he did not commit in order to get out of prison after serving 30 years for a crime he did not commit. And that's, you know, that's why I call it anatomy of injustice.
Were you there with him when he was released?
Yes.
What was that day
well,
like?
Well, it was very emotional. It was as Diana said, Diana Holt said, it was bittersweet. On the one hand, for him to walk out of prison after 30 years was a wonderful feeling. But to have had to have pled guilty to a crime he didn't commit in order to walk out of prison, that left a very uncomfortable taste in a lot of mouths.
And what will happen to him now? Does he have family? Does he have support?
He does have family. I mean, he has very loyal family members, brothers and sisters. He'll live with them. They're very supportive, but it'll be difficult. He's going to have to find work, which won't be easy. He grew up in abject poverty, and the family still lives in abject poverty, basically. So hopefully some funds are going to be set up to help Elmore.
Do you think that the same case could happen today?
Of course.
That racism like that still exists?
It's not just racism, Emily. It's more the prosecutorial misconduct. It doesn't have to be racism. It has to do with police in a hurry to solve a crime, a prosecutor willing to do whatever it takes to get a conviction, and horrible defense lawyers. But I think the most troubling is the state, the police, and the prosecutor. And you hear about it all the time. And that's more troubling than the racial issue.